I'll tell you that for the better part of 10 years, I was too scared to raise capital, too afraid to take someone else's money. And what changed for me was.
Welcome to the Big Picture Blueprint. I'm your host, Dan Habercost, along with Mason McDonald. And we're going to discuss all things land, real estate, and business in general with all kinds of exceptional people. Let's get started. All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Big Picture Blueprint. I'm your host, Dan Habercost, along with my co-host, Mason McDonald. We have an awesome guest today. But before we bring him in, Mason, how's business for you?
Business is great. Starting off the year strong. I think there's a lot of optimism in the market and all over the country, whether it's the deals I'm doing in Arizona or Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, and excited about some of the stuff that you and I are working on, Dan, in terms of moving into the commercial real estate space and business ownership space on that side. And I think our guest today will be able to provide a ton of valuable insights into that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel a sense of accountability here where I met Ash Patel, who's our guest, who I'll introduce momentarily, years ago when I was on the Best Ever podcast, which he is one of the hosts for. And we talked about commercial real estate, of course, and what I was doing up to that point. I told him I wanted to move into that space. And since then, I've continued to buy residential properties. I have not yet purchased a commercial investment property, but we'll get into that. So Ash Patel has been in commercial real estate now for 15 years. Prior to that, he had a 15-year corporate career, and he invests in just about everything that is not residential housing under the umbrella of commercial real estate. So retail, industrial, warehouse, medical office, and we're talking both buying existing product and building from the ground up. And the commonality with everything is being a bit more creative, staying in less well-understood spaces allows for higher returns. So Ash, great to have you. How are you doing today?
Awesome. Dan, Mason, thank you so much, man. Glad to be here.
Wonderful. Is there anything you want to add to that intro or tell the listeners about yourself before we dive right in?
No, you hit it. Just look where no one else is looking and look for higher returns than what everyone else is doing. Throw the playbook out and make your own.
I love that. Yeah.
I like the sound of that.
Yep. All the.
Yeah, and off.
Go ahead, Mass.
I'm going to interrupt you, Dan, because I'm getting excited about this. I hear those words of higher than normal returns, where no one else is looking, and to me, my risk radar goes off. So let's get into what asset class you're actually talking about within commercial real estate and why my risk radar shouldn't necessarily be going off.
That's a good question. So we will do anything from office, retail, industrial, medical, ground-up development, industrial, well, sorry, I said that, flex. And now risk, right? You read the headlines and you have the big box closures, Toys R Us gone, JCPenney survived, the World War, the Great Recession, the Great Depression gone, Bed Bath & Beyond, Rite Aid Pharmacy gone, a lot of big box closures. Office, every day in the headlines, it's another giant, $100 million office tower being given back to the bank. And yes, like those types of assets should worry you. But, look at neighborhood retail, where you guys and where your audience likes to shop, where the dog groomer is, the barber, the nail salon, the pizza place, the deli. Those are typically internet resistant and recession resistant. In terms of office, we absolutely love office, but it's suburban office. Suburban office in a downtown walkable suburb, right? Not the giant high-rise office buildings or not even the office parks in the suburbs. We're talking about the people that cannot effectively work from home, and they just need an office close to their house. So you see, vast residential land and one office building in the new downtown hotspot suburban area. Post-COVID, we got used to not going to city centers and going to the bars and restaurants that are closer to home. And we've just gotten used to that. People moved out of city centers into the suburbs. The millennials were all living downtown. And eventually, just like the previous generations, they were going to move out to the suburbs. COVID accelerated that. So right now, suburban retail, suburban office is on fire. Anybody that owns, a one or two, maybe three-story small office building, 10,000 square feet or so in the suburbs, will tell you they have a waiting list of people wanting to get in to rent single offices, right? And look, where you guys shop, where your families and friends shop, I mean, those are suburban shopping areas.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I would imagine that a lot of your tenants are people like Mason and I, small business owners who either have to or are going nuts trying to work from home. And is that about right? Is that the demographic?
Yes, our office tenants are either people that their employers have stated, look, you don't have to come into our office 30 miles away downtown, but you have to come into an office. So a handful of them will get a stipend to rent office space. Because, you know, when COVID first started, Dan, the metrics came out and everybody was more productive. Well, maybe, right? Possibly, because if you normally left your house at 8 a.m., you started working at 8 a.m., so you didn't have that commute time. Over the last 3 years, we've gotten very complacent. You go out to a bar, restaurant during the weekly lunches. It's amazing how many people are sitting outside, nice day, enjoying a cocktail. You never would have seen that pre-COVID. So these are people that are working from home, and the latest metrics are, on average, they're 3 to 4 hours less productive per week when they're working from home. So yes, we have a handful of companies who give their employees a stipend to rent an office. We also have people that, you know, maybe they have a spouse that's also working from home, and the kitchen table is just no longer a conducive work environment, especially in the summer when you have kids and pets running around. So they've realized that if they want to be productive, they need an office. We have small businesses that have outgrown their home office that need to rent a 1 or 2 person office. And, you know, we've also got people that, for example, one of our latest tenants, 2 guys that run a travel company, they do 1 webinar 1 night per week and leased out an entire office for 2 years because they realize it's not fair to their family to be very quiet between the hours of, you know, 6 to 8 p.m. every Wednesday. Because dad's on a podcast, right? Dad's on a webinar. So it's just people realizing they cannot effectively work from home.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, I'm wondering here, since at least there seems to be, from the outside looking in, a huge imbalance between the demand and investor sentiment. So are you kind of having a bit of a field day right now where you're finding more deals?
Yes. So office, you can pick up for 50 cents on the dollar. Right? If not, a little bit less. We're waiting for those giant office buildings to get down to about 35 cents on the dollar. And, you know, the next question is, well, look, if no one's renting those, what are you going to do? If you drive by one of those suburban office parks, maybe there's 4 or 5 mid-rise buildings, you know, 10 stories or so. The parking lot is very desolate, but it's maybe 10% full. So if you can buy one of these buildings for 35 cents on the dollar and your cost basis is 1/3 of the rest of the buildings there, you can afford to lease out your space for 1/3 of the asking price. So if everyone else is at $18 a square foot, you can be at $6, $7 a square foot and be profitable. You will undercut all of your competition. What few people there are left that want office space will come into your building.
Ash, a question on that. I saw back in November that WeWork filed for bankruptcy, a company that was valued, I think, closer to $50 billion. Whenever you see something like that, does that get you and your investors excited because you kind of see this prediction of the future of, okay, this is why I'm saying that there might be the potential of getting these office buildings at 30 cents or so on the dollar?
Yeah, so other people's failures don't excite us. However, the writing was on the wall with WeWork. They had an unlimited budget from SoftBank, and they spent it, right? They were one of the largest property holders in the U.S., and they just overspent. If the economy continued to thrive, they might have done okay. But we love that model. We have co-working space as well, and it's very profitable. It's a great business model. It's similar to what airlines do. You know, if they have 100 seats, they'll sell 120 tickets. They always overbook. It's the same concept with co-working, right? You can have, you know, 70 actual co-working spaces. but you can have 150 memberships because not everybody shows up at once. So we love the model, and I think the model's here to stay, right? WeWork failing. There's still other companies like Cohatch that are out there. I think that model will continue to thrive. And for anybody that's never visited a co-working space, the vibe once you walk in is amazing. You just see everybody else working, grinding, collaborating. And in the back of your mind, you're like, man, they're here to eat my lunch. This is my competition. I better get to work.
I like that. And for me, I was in the healthcare industry, so C-suite of a hospital. So COVID for me was a very different experience than a lot of the corporate employees, like my wife, a software engineer that went remote and stayed remote forever. So I know that you have this co-working space that you're selling right now. Would you be interested in kind of doing a deal deep dive of Station Loftworks out in Atlanta?
Yes. It's one of the ones that my partner manages. So we bought this for $1.6 million, I believe. This was on LoopNet for quite some time. And real estate people, they don't want a business, right? They want real estate. And my partner said, hey, I've got this property that looks intriguing. And she really liked it. And I said, look, just to warn you, you're buying a job. This is not passive like everything else we've done. And it took her by surprise, right? There was a lot of work. You are now a business owner, so it's not for everybody. But once it's up and running, you've got a good staff in place. It essentially runs itself. And, you know, what's also trending is those virtual mailboxes, right? You see a lot of sponsored ads on that kind of stuff. That's also something that we've incorporated. So it's, I think, $75 per virtual mailbox. And all it is you give somebody an address and a suite number. So the landscaper, the insurance company, they can have a Google address. So when somebody does a search for snow removal near me, it's one of the listings that'll pop up on a Google search, right? So people want those local addresses and they don't get any mail there. And if they do, they never come to get it. It's essentially getting $75 per mailbox for doing no work other than the initial setup. But to continue on with that, you know, this was built by somebody who never raised rates. He was an engineer that was kind of doing this as a hobby. He believed in the concept. He just wanted to see if it would work. And he got it up and running for 6 years, never raised rents. They're way below market, but it's just an incredibly cool space, a place that, you know, my partner was there this Saturday morning. And she's like, man, I just fell in love with this place again. Like, it is just the coolest atmosphere, you know, mixture between urban and just trendy, just a neat place. So if you have a co-working space, it's got to be inviting. It cannot look like a sterile office building, right? Because people can go back to their corporate job for that. It's got to be someplace hip, common areas, near bars and restaurants that you can walk to. But yes, a great business model. I encourage people to either look at office conversions or look at buying existing co-working businesses.
Okay, excellent. So more work than she had initially wanted. So you guys, sounds like, improved it and are exiting now.
Ideally, we don't have to exit. It's just one of those things that it's stabilized. So let's sell it.
Sure. That makes sense. Okay. So along... I could focus on office for the whole podcast, but there's some other topics we really want to get into. So sounds like there's huge opportunity in office right now, especially in the suburban office. And then for the large scale office, you're looking for even deeper discounts. Makes sense. Now, Mason and I right now are working on potentially buying a commercial building in one of the tertiary markets here in Colorado and putting in a pet supply store. It's right next to pet grooming, boarding. It's surrounded by upper middle class single family homes. So talk to us a bit about retail. Can you share what you're doing on that front? Are you doing any acquisition in the retail side?
Do you hear about the deals that Dan and I are doing and feel like you lack the capital or knowledge to do them yourself? Allow us to be your partners in this and visit gupland.com to learn more about how we can provide you with all the capital to complete land transactions, as well as the expertise and guidance for you to create your own business. Visit us at gupland.com.
Yes, a couple things though. Let's solve your problem and walk through that scenario. But the last thing I'll say about office is, was it Warren Buffett that said, when everyone else is fearful, be greedy. When everyone else is greedy, be fearful. So everyone's fearful of office, be greedy. Everyone's greedy on the stock market. It's at an all-time high, be fearful, right? How many square feet is your space that you're looking at?
Do you remember that offhand, Mason?
I think that one was right around 4,200 square feet, give or take. We drove the neighborhoods and everything last, I think Thursday or Friday, and saw a few vacant buildings that serve as opportunity and a good amount of vacant land too. If the business model pro forma is out well enough that we could purchase and go vertical.
Is it in a relatively newer strip mall?
Older.
Okay. The problem with an older strip mall is you're not going to get a national tenant. They don't want their brand in an old strip mall, right? So if you wanted to attract one of the bigger players, you would have to redo the facade, just modernize the facility. However, where you guys are located, you guys are probably one of the most dog-friendly states ever. I'm sure you can find some boutique pet stores that can do very well. So I would potentially get this under contract and get an extended due diligence period. Reach out to every single pet person. Get on Etsy, get on Facebook Marketplace. Anybody who has anything to do with pet supplies, call them. Find out if they're interested in renting space for retail operations. And if they're not, ask them who they know that is, right? And now, if you get the tenant on a lease, you buy the building. If you don't have any luck, you walk away.
So question on that, and Dan and I are going to use this show selfishly to get your advice on it. We're anticipating potentially being owner-operators of going in and owning the actual real estate and the pet supply store or whatever potential business. Pet supply store just works out well because there's zero in the entire city that we're looking at doing this business in, even though there's, just like you're saying, it's Colorado, everyone owns a dog, and there is the grooming salon, the boarding that's always full and that has great business. With something like that, do you think it makes sense for our first venture into commercial real estate being an owner-operator or seeking out that potentially mom-and-pop size or mid-sized tenant that we bring in and put on a triple net lease?
Are you guys incredibly bored and have a massive amount of free time?
Yeah.
No. Oh, hell no.
But we've been looking at adding something to our, just to our portfolio where it's not in the stock market. It's not traditional real estate. Of, you look at the margin on pet supply store and it's fantastic. Of, we want something that brings in consistent revenue every month, and it does seem like fun.
But a friend in town here who owns a pet store in one of his buildings, and he owns the store as well, and it just prints cash. And so the specific area we're looking at is, there's a huge road that's, long story short, it's about to have a tremendous increase in traffic. And it's a market, 89,000 median income, Mason, I think was it. And there's no pet store yet grooming it. So just to paint the full picture, but I'll pause there.
When's the last time you guys hired somebody?
I had a new person start today, a new W-2 employee, actually.
Okay. What do you want to do when you grow up?
Be retired, I think, more than anything. And I definitely understand the management side of things. Before jumping into this, I had about 30 direct reports and 500 employees under me, and I don't miss the management side of things. So bringing in a great operator is absolutely the most important aspect of this business in our mind.
Mason, those people that you had under you, did you do all of their tax filings, their health insurance, not your company, you personally? Did you deal with withholdings? Did you deal with vacation times?
Not a chance. I had a CFO and we had a corporate office and everything.
Guess what? When you hire these five or so people to run this store, you're doing all of that, right? Now, I admire what you guys are trying to do. My very first property, I had the similar mindset. But what I'll tell you is that you've seen people that chase something and they're not passionate about it, right? People that get into real estate for the money, and if they don't live and breathe and love it, they're not going to be successful. There's no longevity. So if you guys are doing this just for the money and you don't have a love of moving pet products, I wouldn't advise it. And if you do do it, make sure you have a plan to get 5 or 10 of these stores, right? So doing a one-off, man, it's just a recipe for making your lives miserable and inundated. You got to set up the POS systems, all the in-house internet, the cameras, suppliers. You got to establish new relationships with pet suppliers, dealing with tax issues. It's not for the faint of heart, but Dan, you said you had a friend in this space, right? Why wouldn't you lease it out to him or her?
He is up north in Colorado Springs. He doesn't do anything down in this market.
Okay. I wonder if he would franchise to another operator or entertain, you know, maybe opening a second location here, or even an off-branded location, whatever. Again, I admire where you guys are going. My very first property, there was a grocery store / selling beer to college kids store on a college campus. The reason I bought that building was mixed use was because I thought when the lease expired for that store, I can take that over and have another source of income, right? If I had actually followed through with that, I would have been a convenience store owner instead of a real estate guy, right? So look, if you're passionate about it and you want 10 of these stores, by all means, do it and kill it. But it's shiny object syndrome when you do a pro forma and you look at margins and you're like, man, they are printing money. It'll be 2 years of your life that will be invested in this.
I think that's fantastic advice. And whenever I saw exactly what you said with that, with the co-working space and how it's, oh crap, that's a whole other job. Part of the reason behind going into this entrepreneur world is not necessarily to give up a job, but exactly kind of what you're saying along the passions and in enjoyment of it. And I've got two dogs. I love dogs. But do I want to be communicating with all of these sellers of all of these huge companies and everything like that? And that's it's fantastic advice. So sometimes the shiny object is actually a lot duller as soon as you get closer to it and you're working with it.
Yeah, Mason, during COVID, I had a vacant restaurant building. And long story, but I ended up partnering with somebody that was a lifelong restaurateur and opened 1.5 restaurants, but it was 2 years of my life in headspace that I'll never get back. And we were losing $1,000 a week for a year. And it was just absolutely miserable. I became a restaurant owner. And look, my agreement with this individual was you can have my money, you can have my building, but you can't have my time. And that didn't work. All of my time was spent on these restaurants. And it was a really bad idea, lesson learned. So you can't be a partial business owner / real estate investor / podcast host / family, husband, boyfriend, whatever. You've got to be all in on whatever it is that you want to take to the next level.
That's fantastic advice. And we appreciate you giving it to us because it really is, just like you said, the pro forma is so attractive of owning it. Sounds great, but it's really hard to be a passive owner where whenever the manager doesn't show up or does a call off and all the employees do call off. So looks like Dan and I are going to be slinging dog food on a Saturday afternoon instead of skiing or doing our own other business and everything, which is not what the end goal is.
Sorry, one thing you could do is if you get a tenant in there, ask for 4 or 5 or 6% of their sales. Right. So now you benefit on the upside. So in their lease, maybe give them a little bit of a reduction in rent, but you now have 5% of gross revenue that comes to you guys in a check.
That's great right there. And I think that's the beauty of something like this, where we see the opportunity, we see the business plan, and whether finding the tenant becomes a lot easier of, hey, look at how prime this location is for this specific business within this market. Here's a great lease opportunity. Here's a creative lease opportunity where there can be discounts here, providing some capital for initial inventory and collecting some source of the revenue coming in. And which kind of shifting gears a little bit, but staying on the same topic, where with all of the stuff that you're doing that's not multifamily, you talk about creativity, and I think that's something that we just discussed there. I know that I was watching a YouTube video about medical office space. I would love to hear about your experience in the medical office space and why that is such an attractive asset class within commercial real estate.
Great question. The opposite of a medical tenant is a restaurant, right? Where restaurants are on very thin margins and rent is a significant expense for them. Doctors or medical practitioners, they're on very high margins and rent is not a big part of their overall P&Ls, right? So you'll never have a medical tenant that's like, man, I'm going to try to make rent this month. I'm going to do my best. Sorry, I'll get you next month, right? I mean, to them, it's nothing. It's rent. It's just a normal expense. They're also very sticky tenants in that if you have, let's say, an optometrist and they're at a particular location for many years, they really can't leave because if they do, you can put the word out, hey, what optometrist wants to take over this office that's been in an optometry office for 20 years? Everybody would jump on that, right? So they're very loyal to their locations. The patients are used to going to this location to visit this doctor. Doctors can retire and change, but they still want to go to that location, right? And they also pay higher than market rents. So medical office always commands a premium. Sorry, so we've done ground-up development for medical centers, and they are very profitable. We've never had a doctor miss rent, right? And they're triple net leases, so they're responsible for taxes, insurance, maintenance. It's one of the best types of real estate to own. They also trade at lower cap rates because investors know, you know, this doc is not going anywhere.
Absolutely. And I think with doctors, where a lot of businesses where they might have a slower month or something like that, doctors rely on insurances to pay them timely. But there's so many solutions and businesses out there where it's the cash advance model of some physicians might have a lot of VA patients and it might take 300 or 400 days to get payment, but they're able to get that payment regardless because it's the government and it's going to come due. Whenever you're looking at these medical office spaces, a few questions. One, market, are you looking for that same kind of suburban market? And then two, specialty. Are you looking for primary care clinics, just typical general practitioners, or have you gone into the specialty space of orthopedics or cardio or anything like that?
Two great questions. In terms of markets and location, the one thing for any real estate purchase is, can they replicate this next door or nearby? If there's a bunch of vacant land all around you, and somebody can build a newer, better medical office, I'd be a little bit fearful unless you're buying this at such a great deal. But the beauty of medical office space is it could be nestled in the heart of a neighborhood where nothing else could go in there, right? But it's fine because that's what you need. You want people where the doctor's office, dentist office is just down the street. So location is less important as long as you can kind of be cognizant of your competition, right? Can they open something next door? Specialties, I would be a little bit cautious about primary care physicians. I would prefer a specialty. The reason I say that is primary care physicians are often bought up by larger systems or by hospitals, right? When you have a primary care doctor, they're the ones that are making referrals to the orthopedic, to the podiatrist, to the whatever specialist. So if the hospital can control primary care docs, they can say any of your referrals have to be within our hospital system. So they often buy up individual practitioners that are just primary care physicians.
Great. Yeah, great answers and great response there, because it's such an attractive business model to buy, where whether it's a hospital group or a private equity firm that comes in and is looking to build out their primary care portfolio within their practice and everything. So that's fantastic. And just another shiny object that from the real estate side that Dan and I are definitely interested in as well.
I'll share something with you. A lot of guests that are on podcasts share their wins, right? But I feel like you learn a lot more from the losses. And that's what I want to share. So I had a medical broker call me, medical real estate broker call me and say, Ash, I got this medical office right down the street from where you live, currently selling it at 7.5 cap, but they only have 2 years left on their lease. And I was in the car, wasn't really paying attention. I'm like, yeah, man, not interested. Don't love that location. I don't want to deal with 2 years on a lease. And I hang up, not think much more of it. And a few weeks later, he's like, hey, remember that building I called you at? He's like, we got the doctor to sign a 10-year lease. It's now being sold at a 5.5 cap. So I lost out on hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? Because I was too lazy or wasn't paying enough attention to the broker. Where what I should have done was say, yes, I'm very interested. Let's talk. Look at the lease, talk to the doctor and say, hey, you know, how long have you been here? Do you like it here? Is business good? Year over year numbers are good. Would you consider signing a long-term lease? And probably more often than not, you'll hear, well, yeah, I don't want to go anywhere. And then you got them, right? A 10-year lease, just that one signature could have made hundreds of thousands of dollars.
When Mason and I were starting our land businesses, capital was the biggest hurdle for both of us. Over the years, we found this is the case for nearly everyone in the land business. And that's where Ground Up Partners came from. Ground Up Partners is a capital provider for land deals. We'll bring all the funds necessary to close the deal. You just bring the signed contract. Visit gupland.com to submit your deal and get started today. So kind of going forward then, when you're looking for, well, really any commercial building, but medical office, are you more looking for the buildings where the lease is about to run out? Is that a form of value add where a lot of people ignore those and you've found them to be productive?
Yes, and that's not just going forward, right? This is stuff that I teach others and what to look for, and I knew better. But yes, lease expiration is one of the biggest factors in retail. And, you know, it's one of the biggest hurdles of investing in commercial, namely retail, is people say it's too hard or it's too expensive. Well, one, it's not too expensive because I can find a strip mall that is priced similar to a residential single-family home or a duplex, right? So there's retail real estate out there that's inexpensive, too difficult. Retail, every single deal is different. I'll give you an example of that. We bought a strip mall that had maybe a dozen tenants and had the same owner for I don't know how many years. Every single lease was vastly different. So when you're underwriting that, you've got to read every page of the lease because there could be one paragraph that changes the value by hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, an example of that is, you know, we have one tenant that's on triple net. They're responsible for paying taxes, insurance, roof repairs, AC replacements, everything. And they're also responsible for paying their pro rata share of any parking lot repairs, lighting upgrades, sign upgrades, right? The tenant right next door to them is on a gross lease. They just pay $2,500 a month and that's it. So, and then, you know, you can get granular. We have a Dollar Tree that has a sight line provision. And what that means is in front of the Dollar Tree is a giant parking lot where we don't even need half of it. So it'd be nice to build something in that parking lot, an outlot. Well, Dollar Tree had a sightline provision where if you take the two corners of the front of their building and draw two imaginary lines straight to the street, nothing can impede that view, right? And that's literally one paragraph in a 65-page lease. And you literally have to read every single word of every single lease to do your underwriting. Right. So that's what complicates retail. And to this day, I've been doing this a long time. Every time we see a lease, I see something I've never seen before. So they are all different. And underwriting retail is a bit of a challenge.
Absolutely. And due diligence is one of the most important aspects of this business and one of the most boring parts, too. Are you the one that is going through all the leases yourself within your business, or do you have attorneys, teams of attorneys, assistants that are doing that for you?
A good question. I hired an analyst and I heard one of the greatest things anyone's ever said to me. He said, man, I really love reading leases. And that's one of the things I despise, right? At times we'll have attorneys look at them. I've been doing it long enough that I can handle a lot of it myself. And Dan, I didn't answer your question. I went off on a tangent about lease expirations, right? So it's quite tricky in that a few years ago, having long-term leases was ideal. When inflation hit and, you know, the apartment people were raising rents 10, 12, 15% annually, we couldn't do that if somebody had a long-term lease, and especially if they had renewals as well. We have to honor their renewals, right? So in that scenario, we were looking for properties that had lease expirations coming soon. Now we're back to properties that have lease expirations in the future that are guaranteed leases, right? So the market conditions dictate how soon you want that lease to expire. Also, if somebody's paying way below market, you want that lease expiring sooner than later. If they're paying way above market, you want that lease to be drawn out. So there's some variables involved in lease expirations.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would love to find someone similar to your employee who loves to read leases. I think Mason and I, and you probably share the trait of enjoying this sort of thing, enjoying finding deals, but my goodness, anything detail-oriented is not our strong suit.
Is that the same with both of
you? Yeah.
We both tend to be more the public speaker that is useless when it comes to details.
Okay, so you guys are the visionaries. Do you have an integrator that you've hired?
So, not directly. My acquisition managers are much better with details, and they handle the transaction coordination as we close these deals. And then the title agents, man, in each state I'm doing business, and this is similar to him, have been incredibly helpful because they're kind of serving as that role, but not a direct, you know, admin person.
Are you guys inundated right now? How's your workload?
Mason, you can answer separately, of course, but I'm pretty available. I knock out the key things in the morning, and then my afternoons are very open.
Agreed with Dan. I think the goal is taking all of those things that we don't enjoy that there are people out there just like your analyst that are better at it and going to be more consistent with it and working on offloading that so we can continue to focus more of our time on what our main interest is right now and what we're devoting most of our time and energy to, which is raising capital, which is somewhere I'd love to kind of move the show towards and ask you a few questions about.
Yes, before we do that, a question for you, if you don't mind. I'm assuming you guys are both full of ideas, constantly have things bouncing around in your brain, right? Are you also the type of people that will start a lot of things, but just for whatever reason, don't finish them?
I've gotten much better there just from self-awareness, from having these conversations for the last 6 years. But so not, I haven't been too bad there. Mason, how about you?
Same thing. It definitely sounds like we have that ADHD, ADHD personality and diagnosis and everything that makes it seem like we're very scattered. But I think in general, it's the ideas that bounce around all the time. But if it's not in line with the current business that I'm operating and what my goals are for the next 6 months, 1 to 5 to 10 years, then I usually won't allow myself to do it. I love exploring the idea, but not necessarily starting it unless it's in alignment.
Okay, so this is not only for the two of you who seem to have a great grip on this, but for your audience. And I've had this conversation with a ton of business owners where they fault themselves for starting a lot of things, not following through. I used to look at people's desks in the corporate world where they were completely empty every morning and every night. And I'm like, man, this year I'm going to be that person where I can knock out everything on my plate and keep a clean desk. What I'll tell you is if you have the ADHD, squirrel syndrome, bunch of ideas bouncing around in your brain, it is an absolute superpower, right? You are a visionary. You just need somebody that next to you that can take all of these ideas and run with them, right? So don't fight it. I talked to another business owner who's taking a bunch of supplements to help him focus. And I'm like, no, like that's going to dull your thoughts, man. You need to embrace what you have and literally write stuff down, fire it off to the person who is your integrator and just move forward, right? Focus on like Mason said, focus on things that you enjoy and that are of high return. So thank you for allowing me to share that, because I think it's important for a lot of people that come down hard on themselves because they just can't follow through with things, but it's a superpower. Capital raising, let's go.
Just one follow-up to that, because I think that's very true. There's the visionary, the integrator, the CEO or the COO. And I think something that a lot of people don't necessarily realize is the idea of the sunk cost fallacy is what causes so many CEOs to fail, is whenever they continue to focus on an idea and just continue to double down on it and double down on it, as versus letting it go, where if you have lots of ideas, it's okay to pick one and stick with it for a little while and see, oh, wait, opening and operating a pet supply store doesn't work for us. How do we pivot? How do we change it and everything like that? So I think the sunk cost fallacy is relatively in relation to what we're talking about here. But yes, capital raising, let's go. Dan, you want to get us started there?
Yeah. So I saw one of your deals come out from your company, Invest Beyond Multifamily. Are you mostly syndicating, raising money for these? How does capital, or what does capital raising look like for you?
I'll tell you that for the better part of 10 years, I was too scared to raise capital, too afraid to take someone else's money. And what changed for me was, and look, I had a lot of friends that were seeing me, seeing what I'm doing, and they would ask proactively, Ash, would love to invest with you, man. Let's sit down, let's talk. And I would always kind of push them away. You know, no, man, I'm good. I'll let you know, but I'm good. I had no intentions of ever raising capital from anybody. I didn't want that burden or responsibility. What changed for me was I saw these friends, they were investing in the dumbest things, bars, restaurants, crypto schemes, marijuana companies, you name it, the FOMO investments, right? This could potentially hit big and I don't want to miss out. There were people taking out home equity loans to invest in some of these dumb things. And I finally realized if I let them into my deals, they could, for the first time, see what it's like getting a return on your capital and be a little bit smarter about their investments. So I opened it up to friends initially. And any deal we do now, I'll open up to investors. We are always prepared to take down our own deals. And I could say that because, you know, in the apartment world, there's $30, $40, $50 million apartment complexes. There's no $30 million strip malls, right? They just, our price points are $3 to $10 million. And we always get, 75, 80% loan to value. So we're always prepared to take down our own deals, but we will open them up to investors if they want in. The reason we do that is a couple things. One, it's great when these people are like, man, that's awesome. You're helping us like realize our financial goals a little bit faster. The other reason is at some point we may run out of money and find a great deal. So we want to build that investor trust now, right? So that's what we do with all of our deals. What we typically try to do is save half the deal for us. So we will come in as a 50% LP partner. The problem lately is that we'll just get oversubscribed. And people that are in, we try to limit them to 100,000 per person. And we have people that argue with us, right? They're like, nope, we want two on this one. And they're returning investors. So it's like, we're oversubscribed, which is a great problem to have. But capital raising, what have you guys done to raise capital?
Yeah, up to this point, it's been friends and family, people I've met at the real estate group. You know, I'm about 6 years in now. So I will say it's been nice where people are coming to me who met me years ago, I've kept in touch with. They've continued to see me do business, posting about deals on social. So it tends to be via just networking and this sort of thing on my end. Mason?
Yeah, similar. And I think that, Ash, something I want to take out of what you said that I've kind of had to realize in my business is I'm helping my friends and family that are investing with me by giving them consistent and significant returns, and sometimes far above triple to quadruple digit annualized returns on deals. And I think that mindset shift was a huge thing for me. So friends, families, fools, the 3S are definitely the primary source. And then in addition to that are our podcasts. Dan and I starting to put content out there pretty consistently, share the deals that we're doing with, have brought people to the table that are interested in lending to us or investing with us. And I think where we see ourselves going is doing it in the more formalized way of potentially creating a fund or something like that.
Yeah, you guys are doing it right. I see a lot of your posts, this podcast, you're getting yourselves out there, right? We had a deal recently that we were brought into. It was somebody who I've been mentoring. And what I try to get through to anyone that I mentor is if you think you're going to raise capital, start putting yourself out there today. Posts, newsletters. Because when you have a great deal, you can't come out of the woodwork and say, hey, I'm raising $2 million for this great deal. People are going to be like, wait a minute. When'd you get into real estate? Like, what are you doing? Hold on. But if you start now and you let the world know, hey, man, so here's what I'm doing. I'm transitioning into becoming a full-time real estate investor. Here's what I'm working on. Would love to hear what you're working on. Subsequent newsletters. Have you ever thought about investing in real estate? You know, let's have a conversation. Book a call. And then finally, when you get a deal, you've spent so much time putting yourself out there, building awareness, building trust, that when there is an ask, people will be interested, right? And that's exactly what you guys are doing. The podcast is phenomenal. All your posts are great. So just keep doing that, right? Add value, build awareness, and then have your ask.
Yeah, guys, I want to emphasize that because I have been amazed. You know, people that from Ohio I grew up with, people I haven't talked to in years, a lot of times they're following what you're doing. You don't know it. And I've had some of these people reach out to me 3, 4, 5 years since I've spoken to them. Hey, I've been following what you're doing. Can I invest with you? Oh, I want to learn. Can I pay you for consulting? That sort of thing. So I just wanted to second that. It is so true. Start putting yourself out there now.
Dan, years ago, I did my first newsletter, and it was because for many years, I was in the corporate IT world, right? My wife and I would go out to dinner and people would ask, hey man, how's IT? And I got tired of correcting people. So I would just wildly be like, yeah, you know what? Life's great, man. How are you doing? And that was a failure on my part. It was a missed opportunity where I could have shared what I'm working on. So I did a newsletter many, many years after I started investing in real estate. And it was just a general newsletter, pictures of my family, letting the world know what we're up to, one pager, and it was amazing. I sent it to every email address I could find from people I've known for the last 20 years, and the next 2 weeks were inundated with people emailing me or calling me that I haven't. These are people that I literally knew, some of them, for 1 year, 20 years ago. I knew them for a year, right? But we were still connected on maybe LinkedIn or Facebook. But you reconnect with these people, and they're, you know, some of them, it was just great to reconnect. Others, they were like, you know what, man, we saved up 300 grand. We've been wanting to invest in real estate, but don't know how, right? So just those newsletters are so important. And, you know, the opposite of that is what people are doing now, where they just become capital raisers, right? I think that's such a BS formula. People that are specifically, they're just LinkedIn capital raisers. They've never invested in real estate. They've never bought real estate on their own. Even the apartments that they live in are rented. But all of a sudden, they're raising millions of dollars in other people's money. And you've seen my posts on this.
Yeah.
There's actual seminars called OPM, right? Like raise OPM. Man, that really drives a nail at me because it is, you know, you've, one, put in your 10 or 20,000 hours first. And then you've earned the privilege of taking somebody else's money. But there's crash courses where you can learn how to be a capital raiser just on LinkedIn. You got to do all these posts and solicit people for money. And then you put their money into somebody else's deal and you get a rip on that, right? And it's technically illegal. It's an SEC violation, but they found ways around it. And it drives me up a wall when I see that.
Yeah,
they don't have the same regard for that person's money as I would as the operator. They're just getting their rip. And if something goes wrong, sorry, you know, we'll get you on the next one. This other deal here is really good, though. Capital raising, it's just building relationships and nothing more. That's it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a succinct way to cap that off there. So we're running out of time, but we've got to touch on how you're finding these deals. You mentioned LoopNet, you mentioned brokers. Are you doing anything direct to seller, or what all does the acquisition pipeline look like for you?
No to direct on seller, but that's an interesting point. In the 15 or so years I've been doing commercial real estate, I've received one postcard from somebody that said, I would love to buy your building, cash, quick close, as is. And it was when I was going through a stack of mail, and I thought, you know what? Good for this person that is out there hustling, and they didn't say, I want to buy your house or your property. It was somebody after commercial. It said, I want to buy your building, right? So I pitched that postcard. When I went to bed at night, I thought, you know, I should sell that building because it's fully leased, not doing much. I've got equity in it. Had that person followed up with me a week or two later, I would have called them, but I didn't have that postcard. Didn't want to sift through the trash. Not that I'm above that, but I probably took the trash out already. So nobody is doing direct marketing in commercial. When I say commercial, I mean non-residential commercial, right? Just no one's out there doing it. So there's an opportunity for people that are wholesalers to get into commercial. How are we finding these deals? We look for mismarketed, mispriced, or mismanaged deals. The easiest being residential realtors posting commercial deals, right? It's like bobbing for apples, but it's easy finding deals that people don't know how to price them. They've never been taught on how to value commercial real estate. So that's low-hanging fruit. Mismarketed, you know, buying something that the description says gross leases. And when you dive into it, they're actually triple net leases, right? Or whenever you're on an MLS site or LoopNet or Crexy, and you see a listing with no picture, most people are lazy and they glance over to the next one because you're there to look at hundreds of listings trying to pick out the good ones. If there's no picture, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to pick up the phone and call? Yes. Those are the ones that no one else is calling on because we're lazy, right? So mismarketed, just mispriced, find a needle in the haystack, right? Something that is just priced way out of whack, but you got to find it before anybody else. You need first mover advantage, which means you've got to look every day, multiple times a day. And I found great deals because I found a deal that was listed incorrectly, and some of them even by commercial brokers, just mispriced. And we jump on it. And after we get under contract, there's a bunch of other offers coming in higher than us, all cash, but it was mispriced. Just mismanaged. Those older properties where you have somebody in their, you know, 60s or 70s or 80s that's owned the property forever, and they're friends with all their tenants, they've never raised rents, and there's an opportunity there, right? So just look where no one else is looking, and mismarketed, mispriced, mismanaged deals.
Yeah, it's good to know that you've been able to buy such high margin deals off of LoopNet, off the public listing sites. I assumed it would have emphasized your whole point of look where other people are not looking, because it sounds a bit easier to get deals in the space. Granted, more due diligence.
Dan, here's another great example for your listeners. Business brokers, right? It's amazing how much of a disconnect there is between commercial real estate brokers and business brokers. Commercial real estate brokers don't know anything about valuing businesses. Business brokers, shockingly, know very little about pricing commercial real estate. So when you have a business broker, they're listing businesses for sale. And oh yeah, the real estate comes with it. Well, dive into those deals and say, look, you know, this machine shop, will the owner consider selling just the real estate? Well, no, they're done. They just want to dump it all and sell it. Awesome. How about this? Do they have any buyers on the hook that want just the business? Yeah, but again, they just want to sell the whole thing. Why don't you let me pair up with one of these business buyers who have no interest in the real estate? We'll buy this together. The business buyer will sign a lease with me, the new real estate owner, and we'll buy this thing for the price that they want, right? Be creative. This is where that creativity wins in commercial real estate, right? But nobody's calling business brokers. No one's looking on BizBuySell for commercial real estate. Look where no one else is looking.
This gets me excited because this is the fun part of the business, is putting together these deals, you know, finding solutions where there's problems. You know, ultimately, that's how you make money in any asset.
Dan, I bought a building. This was in the hottest suburb of Cincinnati. They're downtown. It was this bar restaurant, beautiful, beautiful building, perfect location. Was one of the few buildings that had parking where no one else did. And it was advertised on bizbysell.com as a bar for sale. Well, the bar had closed 2 years prior. The building's been vacant. There's no value in the name. There's value in the liquor license and the real estate. So I had to convince the business broker that nobody's going to buy a failed bar. They want to buy the real estate. I ended up buying the property and the liquor license, and all the surrounding bars and restaurants came up to me and they said, man, we've been waiting for this to hit the market. How'd you get this? It's like, really? I mean, I'm going to wait with everybody else, right? Be creative, man.
No, that's a great example. Now, I am curious on the whole topic of not wanting to operate a separate business. Did you sell the liquor license to an eventual tenant, or how does that work?
I got a tenant in there who is using the liquor license, right? So the liquor license will stay with the building even if they leave, but it's more valuable as a tenant. It's a higher monthly lease because the building has a liquor license.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. Ash, there are a million questions we could ask. We could go for hours here, but I want to be respectful of your time. So you are the founder of Invest Beyond Multifamily. You teach people how to do this stuff. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yes. Thank you. I did have a mastermind. I take 20 people, and over 6 months, we would just meet every Tuesday. I would teach them everything that I know. Each class was about 3 hours long. I did that for 4 seasons, and I don't think I'm going to do it again. It's just a massive time commitment. And we've built a great network, so it's just a closed group. We'll meet every Tuesday forever, but I don't know that we're going to open that up anytime soon to new members. Invest Beyond Multifamily is just my take on real estate in general. Everybody flocks to multifamily. And, you know, the single family person buys a duplex, a quad, a 10 unit, and they're multifamily investors. There's another path, man. Invest Beyond Multifamily. Look at other asset classes. And that's it, man. I'm just a real estate investor.
Great. Anything you'd like to ask or say, Mason?
No, I don't think so, Ash. This was awesome. So much value, so much opportunity, so many things that are getting both mine and Dan's wheels turning. So we very much so appreciate you being on the show.
Yeah, you guys are great hosts. And I love that your show doesn't really have a format. Just go with the flow. So keep up what you guys are doing, man.
Thanks. That's Ash Patel with InvestBeyondMultifamily.com. I'm your host, Dan Haberkost with Mason McDonald, and that's it for the Big Picture Blueprint.
And that's it for today's episode of the Big Picture Blueprint. If you found it helpful, please share it with your friends or anyone you think that it could benefit. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a rating, and we'll see you in the next episode.